If you're ready, we are. Dr. Robert Gilruth, director of the Manned Spacecraft Center, will introduce the participants, and we have brief statements then from the participants.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, before I make my brief statement, I'd like to introduce the people here at the podium. Your far left is Dr. Chris Kraft, operations director of the Manned Spacecraft Center. Dr. George Lowe, manager of the Apollo spacecraft. Chris Charlesworth, mission director, Manned Spacecraft Center. George Hage, overall mission director. My left, Lieutenant General Sam Phillips, USAF, associate administrator for manned space flight. Dr. George Miller, head of medical programs at the Manned Spacecraft Center. Dr. Charles Berry, head of flight crew operations. Dr. Deke Slayton, head of the DOD operations here, General David Jones, and at the far end, Dr. Jack Clark, head of the Goddard Space Flight Center. I'll make my remarks very brief. As you must all know, we here at the Manned Spacecraft Center have a feeling of elation, of relief, and we're supremely happy. I think it's obvious that with the splashdown of Apollo 11, it marks the end of an era and the beginning of another era. I would like to give thanks on behalf of our center here at Houston to all the people who have worked so hard to make this event possible, to the great people who built the rocket and made it work so well, to the people who checked it out down at Cape Kennedy, to all the network people who did such a tremendous job at tracking, to the recovery forces, and to all of those who, both in government and industry, who've done such a superlative job in support of this mission. I think most of all, as a leader of the center here in Houston, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank every employee at the Manned Spacecraft Center for the job they've done here, working together to make this event possible. I'd like to let them know that I realize the amount of dedication and skill that had to go into making this very complex mission a success. And I'd like them to know that I realize all the long hours and the personal sacrifice that had to go in to their jobs. And I'd like to recognize the understanding and the patience of their families, because this meant, of course, many long hours that their breadwinners were away from them. And while it's an end of one era, it's certainly got to be the beginning of another, even greater one. And I think we'll all work together to go forward and to do even greater things in the future. And I also want to thank the American people and the people all over the world for their support and interest in what I think was a great mission, not only for America, but for all mankind. Thank you.
I know that my colleagues, Bob Gilruth, Wernher von Braun, and Kurt Divis, join me in expressing our deep appreciation and great admiration for the work that the teams led by General Phillips, Dr. Lowe, Colonel James, and Admiral Middleton did to make this mission possible, and for the execution of the mission by the teams of George Hage, Davy Jones, Chris Kraft, and Rocco Patrone. Perhaps the greatest praise I can give them all is to say that they have proved, with the ease that comes of long, hard work, what we all instinctively knew, that man could successfully travel to another planet and return. And because they have proved it, we now stand at what is undoubtedly the greatest decision point in the history of this planet. 4 billion years ago, the Earth was formed. 400 million years ago, life moved to the land. 4 million years ago, man appeared on the Earth. 100 years ago, the technological revolution that led to this day began. All of these events were important, yet in none of them did man make a conscious decision to follow a path that would change the future of all mankind. We have that opportunity and that challenge today. For today, at 11:49 a.m. Houston time, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, we conclusively proved that man is no longer bound to the limits of the planet on which for so long he has lived. We will return to the moon first in November and then at regular intervals in the coming years. But these trips are only the first step. There remains for mankind the task of deciding the next step. Will we press forward to explore other planets, or will we deny the opportunities of the future? To me, the choice is clear. We must take the next step. Should we hesitate to exploit the first step? Should we withdraw in fear from the next step? Or should we substitute temporary material welfare for spiritual adventure and long-term accomplishment? Then will man fall back from his destiny. The mighty surge of his achievement will be lost, and the confines of this planet will destroy him. This is a time for a decision. This is a time for rededication to the spirit of our forefathers, a time for all men to move forward together. The organization that brought men to the moon stands ready for the next step. The knowledge possessed by men is sufficient. The resources of this nation are adequate for the task of carrying out this next step. The will of the people of this nation and of the world will determine whether mankind will make the great leap to the planets. In this moment of man's greatest achievement, it is timely for us to dedicate ourselves to the unfinished work so nobly begun by three of us, to resolve that this nation, under God, will join with all men in the pursuit of the destiny of mankind, will lead the way to the planets. Thank you.
General Phillips. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think the biggest word in my mind today is the word thankful. Apollo 11, as we all know, was an unqualified success, and we have achieved the objective that was set for us in May of 1961. We've proven in the process that the Apollo space system performs as it was intended to perform, and that men of Earth can land on other bodies in the heavens and return to this Earth. It's a tribute to a tremendous team. We've learned a lot in this mission. We've learned, I think, that men can adapt to strange environments, and I was very much impressed with what this crew did while they were on the lunar surface. We proved in that process that they can do very effective exploration. Now, I personally expect some surprises as we get some returns from this mission and from follow-on missions. This mission, insofar as the crew is concerned, isn't yet finished. As we all know, they'll be maintained here in quarantine until the 11th of August, if all goes well. Now, where do we go from here with Apollo? A word about Apollo 12. The primary objective of the next Apollo flight, Apollo 12, will be to deploy an Apollo lunar surface experiment package with several more experiments than we emplaced on Apollo 11, and to bring back samples from another Mari area, as well as the human surveys and exploration of that area. Now that we have accomplished a landing in a Mari in the eastern part of the moon, our primary landing site has been selected as a Mari in the western face of the Apollo landing zone. This landing site the primary site for Apollo 12 is in the Ocean of Storms, which is a mare in the western face of the moon, at approximately 23 degrees west and 3 degrees south. We will identify that as Site 7, which is one of the sites that we have developed over these past years. This mission will have a secondary objective, which is a possible bonus, and I'd like to emphasize the word possible, in that landing ellipse is the Surveyor 3, which was landed on the 20th of April, 1967. The date to which we will prepare that mission is the 14th of November, and that date will be confirmed as we work out the detailed planning. The recycle site for Apollo 12 will be Site 5, as we had it in this mission we've just flown, which is also in the Ocean of Storms, near 42 degrees west and 2 degrees north. The target launch date for that mission, subject to detailed planning of the mission, is the 16th of November, and shortly after the Apollo 11 crew was on the carrier, I signed the instructions for preparing this mission along those lines. I am tremendously proud of the Apollo team, and I'd like to remind the people of the whole world that this is the strongest team that's ever been assembled in the history of man. It has a strength of technical and engineering competence, of scientific competence, and of management competence that's unexcelled. It has the dedication that's necessary to be able to tackle an almost impossible job and bring it through. This team flew 8 flights, Apollos 4 through 11, in the period November 1967 until this date, 20 months. 7 of those, of those 8 flights, 5 were manned, and 3 flights were to the moon. That's a record that I would challenge anyone to exceed. That team, in my view, has an exciting future. Lunar exploration, I think, is going to be tremendously challenging and very exciting for this whole team. This team can do that lunar exploration job, and as far as I'm concerned, it can do anything. All they need is the instructions and the support. I'm proud to have had the opportunity to have served with that team. Thank you very much.
Dr. Law,
do you have a statement? I hadn't planned on making one. All I can say is that, to use a word that has been used too often by the astronauts over the past several days, this has just been fantastic. I think many of us still can't believe that the goal that we set out to do in 1961 has been achieved. I'd like to, in talking about what we have done over the past week, I could talk about many people. People that I've had the privilege of working with over the past 2.5 years now, in a way that I've never worked with people before. They've all done such a tremendous job in working together, North American, Grumman, now people here at NASA, to make this possible. But there's one individual I would like to single out and say just a few words about. This is the man who started Project Mercury, that started manned space flight in this country, who led us through that with the first American manned space flights, led us from that into Gemini, with 10 successful flights where we learned how to operate in space, and taught many of us here all we know today about how to fly men in space, and that is the director of the center, Bob Gilruth. Bob. Bob, I think I speak for all of us here in Houston and the entire country in saying that without you, the events of the past week just would not have been possible. Thanks a lot.
I would like to suggest that on an occasion like this, that we that all the principals here on the podium ought to feel an opportunity to make any statements that they want to make. This, after all, represents the culmination of so much work that these people have done that, while I won't call on individuals, I sure would not want to restrain them from expressing their feelings in their heart this time. So please speak up, any of you who feel so moved.
Bob, I'll speak up.
Yes, sir.
I would state that the Department of Defense representatives are obviously proud and happy to have been in a support position for the program from its inception, and particularly proud to be able to get off on a good start today. But I remind you that we're not through, and we are very conscious of a very important job that must be completed, and that is to transport this very precious cargo of people and material from the Pacific back here to Houston. And I hope that you all stay with us until we get that job done, because we all know how important that is too. Again, we're very proud to be a part of the team, and thank you, Bob.
Any others?
I can't add too much to what's been said. As you've all probably been aware of over the years, the crew seems to get all the credit for the missions. They're sort of at the apex, so to speak, and in general, you don't see the iceberg underneath. But I think I'll let Neil speak for himself when he's in a position to do so. But speaking for all the rest of the crews, I'd just like to enlarge on what George Lowe said, that we obviously, none of us could have gotten here without Bob Gilruth and the total supporting effort of the industry, the program office, flight controllers, the whole business. It's been a real outstanding operation. It makes the crew's job pretty easy. We sure appreciate it.
Yes, sir, Dr. Berry.
I think it's very difficult to put into words the feeling that you can have today when you see these people step out of that spacecraft and walk across that deck. And when you saw their pictures as they actually talked to the president, and the condition that they appeared to be in, and we know that they are in from our initial reports from the MQF. And to think back at the time when Bob Gilruth and some of the people here were involved in the very beginning, when all of the very dire things have been said, and that's been going on for all of the years that any of us have been connected with this program. I think it's been a very difficult thing to convince people what man can do. And I think it's a very wonderful thing, and I guess the happiest day of my entire life to be a part of this team that Bob and all of the people here at this table have had some part in leading, and to know that man has all of this capability that we've thought he had all along. And it's a very gratifying thing.
The others? Dr. Clark.
The Manned Spaceflight Network, NASA Communications Network, Goddard Space Flight Center are all very proud to have been able to serve Apollo as first its ears and more recently its eyes. Hope to be able to continue to do so as the follow-on lunar exploration, the Apollo applications programs continue.
Back to you, Al. Thank you.
Okay, we'll begin with questions, and over on the left-hand side, or rather the right-hand side, Bill Hines.
I have a question for General Jones. Last night at the mission change of shift briefing that Cliff Charlesworth had, he said that the weather in the recovery area was good. That was at 7 o'clock. Around 10 o'clock, the target area was suddenly changed to about 125 miles closer to Johnston Island than it had been before. And some of the more suspicious of us were wondering how much of that change was for the convenience of the president and how much for the convenience of the astronauts.
Well, I think, Bill, that it was just the weather, period. What changed was the reconnaissance flight flew through the area, and I think we agreed that the likelihood of thunder showers was greater to the south, so it was very convenient to move the landing point north because the carrier was in a position to assume that point. And I'm afraid that's all there was to it.
On this side, Mark Bloom.
Ask Cliff Charlesworth, if I may, just how far splashdown was from the target point and the exact time of splashdown. And for General Phillips, does that, what you said earlier, sir, indicate that Apollo 12 would attempt to return to Earth, Surveyor 3?
As far as the target point, based on the inertial system, it was 0.02 of a degree off as measured by the inertial system, and we'll update this and refine this based on whatever data, other data that we have. I do not have the time. I'm sorry.
First row on the right.
There was another part of that question. The answer is no. And I'd like to reemphasize what I said. There's a possible bonus in that mission. If if we are able to land near enough to it to walk to it, then there'll be some examination of it, which is should be a very interesting baseline since it's been there about 2.5 years, but we're not going to bring it back, I'll assure you.
First row on the right.
Dr. Miller, where and when would you wish to take that next great step?
As soon as you and the rest of the people of the nation decide that it is appropriate to take that step, number one. Number two, the where is almost certainly to the planet Mars as the next major goal for manned planetary exploration.
On the right, third row.
To Cliff Charlesworth and Dr. Berry, was there any MASCON problem on guidance, or did the R2 system of the moon work out fairly well? In other words, were you 4 miles south of where you thought you'd be, 800 feet high? You've been through all this before. Was there any real problem due to MASCON or the shape of the moon on the guidance of the lamp?
No, I don't think so due to MASCONs. We did have, we think, a downrange error in the targeting, which we think we understand is probably due to some uncoupled attitude thrustings in lunar orbit, which we think we can determine how to handle that next time out.
Dr. Berry, as I gather from your statement, as of the moment, the astronauts aren't showing any ill effects from any real or imagined moon bugs that may have bitten them while they were in orbit. Am I correct on that?
We have no evidence of anything but normality. They have some minor weight loss, which is the same thing we see with every flight, and there are no abnormalities that we have noted in the exams thus far.
Rudy Abramson.
For General Phillips, on the basis of what happened on this flight, how far would you guess now the Apollo 12 crew will be able to get away from the limb? And if you are able to walk to the Surveyor, what kinds of things might you learn by taking a look at it?
Well, let me answer it in part and then ask George Lowe to comment on it. Subject to the crew debriefing and discussing with them exactly how their EVA went, I think most of us believe from what we saw and heard that the EVAs can be somewhat longer than the one that was conducted on Apollo 11. The duration remains yet to be determined, but somewhat longer than the roughly 2 hours and 45 minutes that crew was out. We do plan to conduct 2 EVA periods on Apollo 12, so the crew will be out twice, and I think each time for a little bit longer than they were on Apollo 11. The exact distance that they will be allowed to go from the spacecraft remains to be determined, but I believe that it will be several hundred feet. And relative to the Surveyor, let me emphasize once more that if we land near enough to walk to it, it represents an object that was precisely known in April 1967 when it was landed. It was one of the surveyors that had a scoop, which scooped a trench, and there were a very large number of interesting measurements and pictures taken. And one of the facts is that there is really no observational evidence of differences on the moon, with the possible exception of the red spots that are reported infrequently at places like Aristarchus. But otherwise, there are no observational differences. There's no baseline against which to measure things. And this object that's been there then that long will represent a baseline against which the environmental effects can be understood over quite a period of time.
Here on the left, right.
Proceeding with that, how long can you extend the total lunar stay time of Apollo 12, and how long for the total Apollo program? What is the longest that you can keep the LAM on the surface of the moon?
I'm going to refer that to George Lowe.
For Apollo 12, our maximum lunar stay time will be of the order of 32 hours. And that's not yet fixed, but it's between 28 and 32 hours. And this is true for the next two flights beyond that as well. We are considering at this time some extensions in that stay time for later Apollo spacecraft, but this has not yet been fully defined.
Stuart Auerbach.
Two questions on the Apollo 12. First of all, will there be improvements in the spacesuit and the PLIS to allow more maneuverability during the EVAs? And secondly, are you going to be looking for environmental changes in the Surveyor spacecraft itself or in the moon around the Surveyor?
Let me take the first part. Both the spacesuit and the portable life support systems will be the same for Apollo 12 as for Apollo 11. And looking at the mobility during Apollo 11, it seemed pretty adequate to me. Far better than I expected it to be, as a matter of fact.
And relative?
On the second part of the question, I'd again like to emphasize the big if that General Phillips mentioned. If we land next to the Surveyor, then, of course, we will make observations both to the Surveyor itself and how it has changed over the past several years and its immediate environment.
Warren Wetmore over here.
Just how precisely is the exact location of this Surveyor known? I know some of the others, there's a bit of uncertainty about them. I mean, how close can you land in a normally targeted descent to such a piece of hardware?
I think the first part of your question, the combination of Surveyor lunar orbiter photography have permitted the map people to very precisely locate Surveyor relative to other landmarks on the moon, other craters and mounds. And I think that having those landmarks and knowing precisely where the Surveyor is relative to them will provide a very good landmark checkpoint for the next Apollo flight in terms of the terminal point guidance.
Roy Neal back here.
A couple of questions for Deke Slayton. Is it conceivable that any of the men of the 11 crew will ever fly again in space? And have any hard decisions been made on the Apollo 13 crew?
Yes, it's conceivable some of the members of the 11 crew could fly, but based on our experience with post-flight activities, I think it's going to be tough to get them back in the saddle again for a while. As far as Apollo 13 is concerned, we have not made any announcements or nor are we prepared to at this time.
Bob Clark here.
A question for Dr. Miller and one for Deke Slayton. Dr. Miller, if the decision were made today to land men on Mars, what is the earliest that it could be done?
Well, sometime after 1980.
What flight do you think will be the first one to carry a scientist astronaut?
Well, I couldn't give you a very good answer on that. At this time, I think we need to, number one, debrief this crew and find out exactly how difficult things are in terms of flying the vehicle. And I think once we get into a mode where we think that the plain old problem of landing isn't all that difficult, this would be a good time to consider flying scientists. And I wouldn't want to guess just what flight that would be at this time.
Let's go here on the right, Art Hill.
Dr. Miller, if a Mars manned landing were approved, how would you go about it? That is, would you follow the same pattern as for lunar flights with orbital missions first, followed by a landing mission, or would you try to combine them into one?
Well, as you know, our plans are by no means complete for carrying out planetary landings. We've looked at various ways of doing it. Obviously, the real question will depend upon what is the basic strategy of the approach. I guess then I'll speculate with you that one would prefer, in carrying out a Mars flight, since it involves a relatively long period of time leaving the Earth to coming back again, perhaps a year and a half to 2 years or longer, that we would like to do as much as possible once we get there. And I would expect, therefore, that one would tend to land on the mission that one goes there in the first place.
Fourth row here, about the center, right here.
Leonard Bickel of Australia. I'd like to ask, in view of the fact that you are working towards extended periods on the moon, whether you have considered the long-term biological effect on man and whether you plan to put any relative of Bonnie's up on that planet before you send a man there for an extended period.
I didn't understand. I heard about biological effects, but I didn't understand what did we expect to put there. I couldn't understand that part. No, I certainly don't think that we have any evidence at the present time that there's a necessity to put any other form of life on the moon than to get man there at the present time. I don't think that we feel that there are any hazards that would require that sort of thing. I think as we develop capability, I fully expect that someday we'll see a laboratory there that will be able to investigate all life forms on that in that kind of an environment.
Dan Partner.
I have two questions concerning any hairy incidents that may have occurred. First, to General Phillips, my office has wire copy attributing to you the statement that seconds before DPI, there was a possibility that the operation might have been aborted.
Seconds before what?
DPI or during DPI.
No, I think that's not an accurate quote. I have observed and will repeat again that the powered descent and landing phase of this mission was, in my view, the hardest part of this mission. And I was on the edge of my chair. There were some difficulties with communications, as you observed. Several seconds, there were also some difficulties with the guidance computer becoming saturated and calling out alarms, which were, I'm sure, giving the crew a hard time. And then in the last seconds, horizontal velocities, which were quite high with the countdown proceeding awfully rapidly toward the abort red line. I'm convinced in my own mind, and I don't know how Neil will see it when he gets back, but that was a team landing with Neil at the controls and Aldrin calling out readings of velocities and altitudes in the cockpit with the guidance officer on Gene Kranz's flight team calling out goes in spite of the alarms on the guidance system and with Capcom under the flight director. Calling all this up to the crew in such a fashion that I considered a team landing and a tremendous tribute to a team effort. Now, Neil will tell us what he would actually have done without the ground participation when he gets back. but sitting in the Mission Control Center, I had a strong feeling that without that ground team part of that landing effort, it might well have been necessary to abort it.
My second question is perhaps to Chris Kraft. Was the ascent stage switch indeed broken off while the pilots were preparing for EVA? The arming switch for the ascent stage?
Either while they were preparing or when they got back in, that circuit breaker, the end of the circuit breaker was broken off, but you must recognize that that was just the end of the circuit breaker, not the circuit breaker function itself, and that it the circuit breaker performed properly when pushed in.
Did they push it in with a pencil?
No, I'm sure they could probably do that with their gloved finger.
And had they not been able to do that, Chris, what would have been the procedure if they couldn't have?
There was a redundant path to fire the engine. It was not a question of not being able to fire the engine. And I could add a word. The breaker evidently was damaged when Buzz got back into the cockpit, because we could determine from telemetry whether we had breakers open or not. And we were observing it the entire period of the EVA. So I would say this did occur when he came back in.
Okay, we'll get all of your questions, if you'll just be patient. Mary, in the first row here.
One for General Phillips and one for Dr. Berry. General Phillips, do you intend to launch the follow-on explorations at 4 months center? And for Dr. Berry, based on what you know medically so far on the condition of the men, how long would you be willing to let them moonwalk?
Schedule for follow-on lunar exploration missions, the instructions that have gone out call for planning to fly these missions up through Apollo 15 at four-month intervals. And beyond that, calls for planning to fly them on an average of five-month intervals, Apollo 16 and on.
John Roberts there.
You want me to answer that one about the...
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I'm glad you asked that about EVA, because I'd like to set one thing straight. I was shown a story last night which appeared from one of the post-flight conferences, and which I was quoted as frowning on some running and a bunch of other misquotes that were in that thing, and I have no idea where they came from. I'd like to make clear what the position on EVA is. I think we did extremely well on this EVA, and that we did far better than what we had anticipated, as a matter of fact. We haven't completed the analysis of all of our data yet, but from looking at any of the methods that are used, we had lower energy costs than what were anticipated for all of the EVA, and it's difficult to say exactly how long you would increase this time. But certainly, I would say that, as has been mentioned earlier, it certainly could be increased, and I think it'll get to be more a question from anything we've seen so far of exactly how much we have left in the way of consumables, how much we have to give the man of oxygen and cooling capability. And I think that we have a great capability here to move about on that lunar surface, and I think the activity that was done was absolutely superb.
General
Phillips, with reference to Apollo 12, does the possibility of trying to land near the surveyor suggest that you'll have an increased amount of hover time in the lunar module so that you could try to pinpoint your landing more?
No, it does not. The performance and weight carrying capability of LEM 6, which is Apollo 12, is slightly greater than it was on LEM 5, but it's in the same general class when you consider the increased weight of the Lunar Surface Experiment package. So it'll be in the same ballpark as this last mission.
Jay Barbary.
This question for Deke Slayton. Deke, with the success of 11, now that you have 8 months to train a crew for 13, can we expect that crew will be commanded by one of the original seven astronauts, and don't exclude yourself?
If I had any choice, it'd be crewed by me, obviously, but I don't. And I guess I can't comment any further on the crew composition at this time. We just aren't prepared to discuss it.
Third row on the right-hand side.
Dr. Muller, to get back to Mars, it may be premature, but it was premature 9 years ago to be talking about the moon. Is it possible to go to Mars, in your opinion, without the use of a space station? And two, if you do go to Mars, would you need more than one ship, perhaps two manned or one unmanned or a flotilla, one carrying supplies or whatnot? Would you care to guess or let us know whether you're guessing, speculating, or what on that?
Would you let me guess later?
How about the space station?
With respect to the space station, clearly we will need something like a space station in order to go to any planet. We do need to be able to live in space reasonably comfortably for periods of a year or more.
Dick Lyons here.
General Phillips, is November 14th the launch day nominal for the seventh site, or is it the landing day?
That's the nominal launch day for the seventh site. And let me add that there's detailed mission planning to be accomplished yet over the next several weeks, really. And we may have the need to adjust that, plus or minus a day, to adjust to the details of the trajectory.
The man in the blue shirt.
For Chris Kraft and Cliff Charlesworth, what aspects of the Flight of 11 gave you the most concern, and are any of them significant enough to keep you from calling it less than perfect?
Well, I think that both Cliff and I would feel that we were concerned about all aspects of the flight. That's our job. If you would say which one would be most concerned about, that would be the... I would feel the descent phase of the flight, because of the we hadn't done it before, and certainly the ascent followed closely on that. I think we were extremely fortunate in the way in which the systems performed, and feel very grateful that we landed as we did.
In the first row,
I think I would agree with that. The only thing, in terms of perfection, I don't think we could call it perfection, because I think we learned some things that we have some work to do on, but certainly we'd have to give it 100%, perhaps not 101.
That's very good. Mm-hmm.
Whoever could answer, I would like to know if the change in the recovery area is likely to speed the return of the men and the rocks back to Houston, one or the other.
No, the ship will maintain its original timeline, and as far as the rocks are concerned, I don't think that difference won't make any, is not significant as far as flying time is concerned. So as far as we know, we'll be on the previous day, agreed on schedule.
Harry Pease in the second row.
I'd like to ask about the specifics of the seven landing site seven. What is there that is of particular interest to you geologically or selenologically?
It's a mare in the western side of the lunar face. You know, we've talked for some time about making the first two landings in Mare areas before proceeding to more difficult areas, be they highlands or craters or what have you. We've now accomplished in 11 and a landing in a Mare in the eastern face. Site 7 is in the western face and is a Mare. And I believe we'll find that there are interesting and significant differences in that respect. And the other reason for picking that is that we feel on the second manned lunar landing we should have a recycle window in case we strike out on preparing the vehicle on the first scheduled launch day, and the recycle of roughly 48 hours or 2 days into Site 5 gives us that opportunity also in that Mare in the western side.
Okay, let's take a question here, and then we'll move in the back.
I guess this is for Chris Kraft. Is it right that one abandons the free return constraint on Apollo 12? And if so, what sort of advantages or speed-ups does that confer?
You abandon the free return from the standpoint of the use of the command and service module, but we tried to maintain the trajectory such that the descent engine could still be utilized to bring you back to Earth. So it still has that safety feature about it. The advantages of this trajectory are primarily to gain a payload for operation around the moon. And that's what we will use the hybrid trajectory for, plus the fact that we are able to adjust the conditions at landing with this kind of the use of the hybrid, such as sun angles, etc., at the lunar landing site.
Roy Neal.
I wonder if anyone in this group could give us some detail on what happens next relative to the crew and the film. I'm looking now at timetables here as to when, for example, we might expect the crew to come out of quarantine. We know that they're supposed to go on tour, but between the 13th and the 16th of next month, in my records, there's a great big gap. So I wonder if you could give us a tighter timetable on those events and the film, too.
Well, I can talk about the debriefing period, Roy. They're due back in here, by my numbers, at 0100 on Sunday morning, the 27th. And we start technical debriefing then that afternoon at 1 o'clock, continue this the next 3 days, I believe. Confirm that. Right up through the 30th, we'll be doing technical debriefing. And on the 31st, we have the program management debrief, 31st, the follow-on crew debriefs. I don't have my August calendar here, but let me try to quote you. I think we then have 1 day for pilot report. We have a day of scientific debriefing and photo debriefing, and 2 days of systems debrief. And that essentially concludes the formal debriefing. They'll be working on the pilot report the remainder of the time they're in the LRL, are due out on the 11th. And on the 12th.
Press conference is on the 12th, 10 a.m.
Yeah.
Right here.
Okay.
Roy, the White House announced those activities on the 13th. We have no definite plan worked out for after that, but we will make it available just a minute that we have one. Roy?
Let me run through the events here on the sample and on the crew and the MQF. The sample departs the Hornet at 10 o'clock tonight. It'll arrive at Johnson Island and then leave there at midnight. It will be flown to Ellington in two aircraft, and split the sample in a 141 and an Oriya aircraft. One of them will arrive Friday morning at 9:30 and the second one at 11 o'clock. The samples will be delivered to the LRL, the first sample box at 10 o'clock and the second one at 11:30 on Friday a.m. Now the MQF arrives at Pearl Harbor Saturday at 2 p.m. It'll leave Hickam by air at 5 o'clock and arrive Ellington at 1 a.m. Sunday morning, and will be moved into place at the LRL for crew transfer at 3 a.m. Sunday.
Roy, we made available last night a schedule on the first release of the both the stills and the motion pictures, and I'll be willing to go over that with you again. It remains the same as last night.
They come back with the Oriya aircraft, the sample return box.
Yeah, but it takes time to process it through the lab. I think it was Sunday morning and Monday morning for the first two batches of film. Is that right?
That's right. Okay, first in the front row here, Roy Bruner in the brown coat.
Oh, this is for Dr. Miller. And you were speaking about the new era. How much will this cost as compared with the cost of the old era?
since I don't really know what the new era is, I'll have to defer the answer to that. On the other hand, one would guess that we've learned a great deal too, and so I'm looking forward to it's not costing anything greatly different than the old era.
The taxpayers, cost to the taxpayer.
I just answered that. I don't think it'll be.
Tom O'Toole in the front row.
A question for Chris Kraft. Chris, there were several real high points at this during this mission. I was wondering, at any point, did you bite through your cigar?
I think that everything up till the time we got to the point where we had been before, we were pretty felt pretty good about it. I must say that the navigation at the time we got to just following getting into orbit around the moon and watching for several orbits was not as we expected, in that the inclination of the orbit did not do the same thing in this flight as it did in Apollo 10, which we had guessed it would, and it did not. We don't have any answer for that at the moment. That then forced us to depend on the landmark track in order to get a fix on the landing site relative to the orbit we were in. So that was not of concern, because contrary to the fact that we were trying to, maybe you think land at a point, I think the fact that we landed and landed safely made it a perfect mission in my estimation. But we did have some problems with the navigation. Following that, the performance up to the time we rolled over and got landing radar was as we expected, but after that point we had some things which did give us grave concern, in my opinion, as to the guidance system performance during that period, in that we were getting alarms that were indicative of an overflow in the computer, and that's bad news, because it indicates that the computer is too busy. And if that continues, you can get behind in the processes that the computer is running through, and therefore the computer could literally give up the ghost, and you would have been forced to abort the mission. And I think that the performance of Gene Kranz in carrying out the operation during that period was superb. His guidance officer and the CAPCOM in particular, and the way those three operated together, I think aided the crew substantially in being able to carry out the mission, because they indeed made a number of suggestions to the crew and how to handle the computer during that period. The guidance officer was Stephen Bales at that time, and I could not praise him too highly, because he, as General Phillips said, did an outstanding job. Now, I don't want you to get the impression that the guidance system was improperly designed, or that we had some improper problems with the program, because we did not. The problem appears to be at this time was a result of one of the rendezvous radar registers being sort of dithered, so to speak, by power supply that comes from the spacecraft, and we had not run a complete simulation. You just can't run a complete simulation of every piece of hardware in the spacecraft, and that appeared to be unknown, at least by the people that were writing checklists. And if you could have had that switch in another position, that would have been prevented. But the mere fact that that was taking place was taking up about 15% of the capacity of the computer, and caused us to be very close to overflowing continuously. So there's no question but what that was the part of the flight which gave us the most concern.
Ben Clark.
Well, Chris, you've been in the control tower or around it, I guess in it, for every manned flight. How did the anxious moments on this flight compare to those on others, say for when John Glenn re-entered with his retro pack still on, so on?
I don't think we had any event during this flight that that was of a similar nature, Ev, but I don't think that anything we've ever done compares to the descent and landing on the moon.
Reggie Turner.
I wonder if I could persuade Dr. Muller to be just a little more specific about Project Mars, since he appears to have staked a public claim to it today. Could you give us some guidance about when you need a go-ahead in order to get there about 1980, how much this particular project is likely to cost, and what sort of scientific manpower you think it would mop up between now and 1980?
You know, excuse me, I don't think I laid any public claim to anything today. I was only expressing a feeling and not a program or a plan. We do not at this time have a firm program or a firm plan, nor have we made the analysis that would permit us to answer in detail either the costs, the schedule, nor the strategy. We do have plans, we do have thoughts, we know the capability that we've been able to develop in the Apollo program, we know the great capacity of the team that was assembled for the Apollo program to do other things. We know that they're capable of operating in Earth orbit and carrying out an aggressive and imaginative program in Earth orbit. We know they're capable of carrying out an aggressive and imaginative program of lunar exploration. We know also that that same team has the capability, the knowledge, and the ability to go to the planets. But the details have to await the decision to go. The time of arrival will depend upon when one starts and the resources that one applies in arriving there.
John F.
General Phillips, but maybe Dr. Miller would care to comment on it too. There's been a lot of talk about the superb team of the space agency now, and I'm wondering just what you're leaving in November or this fall sometime, and I suppose others are leaving, and what's the outlook for keeping the team together?
Well, let me comment on the first part. As an active duty Air Force officer on assignment to NASA for the last 5.5 years, it has been planned by the Air Force, by NASA, and by myself that at the appropriate time I would return to another Air Force assignment. I think that with the completion of the first lunar landing that in due time thereafter is the proper time for me to return to an Air Force assignment. I believe that this Apollo organization it has great depth of capability, and there are many challenges and to me tremendously interesting things to be done in this lunar exploration program. I expect the challenges and the interesting things to provide an attraction for the majority of that Apollo team to continue to pursue these very interesting missions ahead. And I think there's plenty of depth in this organization to carry on and maybe even do better than some of us who have been with it now for some time.
In the front row here.
Do you believe that the guidance problems were due to a switch misthrown at all? And I phrase this in the background that with those thousands and thousands of switches there, it's amazing to me that any of them can be thrown in the right order. But could it have possibly been a misthrown switch rather than a glitch in the power supply?
Negative. It was in the switch position, which was in the checklist, which was in auto.
Okay, we've been going more than an hour. We're going to take 3 more questions. Louis DeRoche.
This is a question for Chris Kraft. You were mentioning this guidance incident that gave you grave concern in the final descent. Does this have anything to do with the LEM landing 4 miles downrange?
No, none whatsoever, Louis. The downrange error was due to the initialization at the time of powered descent. We were about 20,000 feet downrange when we started.
back about the fifth row here, Warren Wetmore.
This is for Chris Kraft. I was wondering, you know, we've been talking about the Mars mission, the manned Mars mission here this afternoon. If you've had any thoughts about how to handle such a mission from a mission operations point of view.
Well, I guess I have to give you a very honest answer and say that I've been too worried about Apollo 11 to tell you how to fly on a Mars mission. But if you want to come to my office someday when I get a little more time to think about it, I'll be glad to talk about it at length.
Okay, this will be it. This last question here.
Dr. Miller, are there any overtures planned to the Russians on behalf of associated activities in space to any degree, or can we foresee that there might be?
Would you mind starting over?
Do you plan any overtures to the Russians as regarding bilateral space efforts in the future?
As you must be aware, we have been carrying on a dialogue for a number of years in finding ways to work cooperatively with the Russians. We've identified several areas. We would plan to continue this activity in the years ahead.
On their recent success and your more colossal success?
I would expect that as our capabilities become comparable, we will be in a better position to exchange information and to explore more and deeper cooperation.
Thank you very much.